Welcome to the podcast that helps you build wealth and thrive in a world of out-of-control central banks and big governments. This is the Rebel Capitalist Show.
All right, guys, it gives me a great deal of pleasure to bring someone back to the Rebel Capitalist Show. He's my good buddy, Rick Rule. Rick, thanks for coming back, my friend.
Always a pleasure to visit with you, George. Thanks for having me back.
Now, I want to start off this interview by having you ask me a question. So I want you to ask me why I am dressed like a Florida tourist with my flamingo shirt on and my crazy glasses.
And your very appropriate hat. Yes,
that's
George.
Right.
Explain
right.
to me why you're wearing the appropriate hat, the crazy glasses, and in fact, the a shirt that would even embarrass me to wear.
Well, Rick, I'm glad you asked. I'm wearing this because I'm so excited about your upcoming conference. And I think it's in Florida, right?
That's brilliant. It is, in fact, in Florida. It
All
is
right. So tell us about the conference coming up that I'm so excited for.
Boy, I'm dumb enough to have missed the lead. That's great. After 30 years now of putting on the Natural Resources Investment Symposium, 27 of those years in Vancouver and two COVID-inspired virtual, we are putting that conference on for its 30th year. Because of public health concerns around COVID, I didn't have the courage to put it on in Canada. I didn't want, my attendees to have to deal with two nations' public health bureaucracy. So we're putting it on in Boca Raton, Florida. Wonderful resort, a resort with a room rate will soon be something like $1,000 a night. We get it for less than a third of that, as an example, but that isn't the important part. The important part is the information at the conference itself. First of all, the fact that this is our 30th year tells us something about the fact that the product has stood the test of time. Why has it stood the test of time? In the first instance, we have always been able to attract some of the great macro gurus from our point of view, the Jim Rickarts, the David Stockmans, the Doug Caseys, the Daniela DiMartino Booths, the Nomi Prinzes, the Grant Williams, people who can put politics and economics in the proper perspective, and importantly, not in a perspective that you would see on CNBC or even the Wall Street Journal. The second thing is that in addition to having these wonderful big picture macro gurus, we have the best natural resource analysts that money can buy. If you agree with the point of view espoused by George Gammon, Doug Casey, Jim Rickarts, how do you go about doing something about it? So it's one thing to get the picture painted for you. It's another thing about being able to afford the picture. So we try and do that for you too. More importantly than that, George, what we do better than anybody else I know is we have for 30 years had what I call the living legends in the conference. Living legends are people who have built multi-billion dollar natural resource companies from a standing start. It is important to understand the construct of history from these people, but it's more important to understand how the lessons that they learned building multi-billion dollar companies impacts their ability to invest money. And how the lessons that they have learned can impact you. You'll hear from Ross Beaty, as an example, who took Lumina Copper from $2 a share to $160 a share when it was broken up. This type of information isn't available at any other conference that I know. By the way, informally following a Robert Friedland or a Bob Quartermain, around the conference floor and listening to what exhibitors they spend time with, listening to the questions that they ask exhibitors is worth the cost of admission by itself. And then we move on to the exhibitors themselves. That's where the rubber meets the road. Everything that you learn in the talks, you have the chance to employ in the exhibit hall. At every other investment conference that I know of, George, the qualification to be an exhibitor is simply to have a check that cashes. They're regarded as advertisers. My attendees for 30 years have told me that my exhibitors are content. And what that means is that we vet them all, and we don't vet them in an academic sense. If they are not owned in my portfolio or in portfolios I manage, they can't come. That doesn't mean, sadly, that every stock I own goes up, George, as you well know. What it does mean is that we have vetted every single exhibitor, and we like them well enough that we've risked our own capital.
Right.
Finally, unlike any other investment conference I know, but like every other investment educational product I've ever offered, this one comes with a full money-back guarantee. If you pay to attend the Natural Resources Investment Symposium and you feel for any reason whatsoever that you didn't get your money's worth, ask me and I'll give you your money back. Now, mercifully, in 30 years of making this promise, the product has been good enough that we've had to refund less than 0.1% of the tuition payments received. But I think it's an important testimony to the conference that we are absolutely confident that the content will be valuable enough that we can make the money-back guarantee absolutely riskless to us. And by the way, by doing that, making the conference itself, at least financially, riskless to the attendee.
Yeah. You know, I just got done traveling in the United States doing kind of like a speaking tour. And I was in Belize with Danielle, and we were doing, we were talking at the real estate guys deal there. And we had the opportunity to go to dinner with her husband, who I don't know if you've met Danielle's husband. Great, great guy. And then just last week, I was at my event and I had dinner with Doug Casey. That was the story I was going to tell you about. And oh, and by the way, so my research assistant, his name is Josh, and Josh had the opportunity to meet Doug, and he's, you know, a huge fanboy, and Doug's like one of his heroes. And what was just, and you'll get a kick out of this story. My research assistant, Josh, actually went to the airport with Doug, or met him at the airport because they had similar flight times. So he got to watch Doug Casey go through airport security and TSA. And if you know Doug Casey, you know why that's so funny. And he said that Doug actually asked one of the TSA people if he was human.
I have in fact had the opportunity, and I use that word advisedly, of traveling across international borders with Doug. And it is something that's not to be recommended except for your own amusement.
Oh, pure comedic value. The first thing I asked Josh, said you had to have recorded that, because please, please, please send me that that video on your phone. But anyway, so let's get into the nitty gritty here. I want to ask you so many questions about commodities and kind of a little bit of macro stuff. And I also want to ask you about some strategic tips. I just listened to your podcast on, I think it was Palisades Radio, where you really took a deep dive into what I would consider your edge and the edge that you have had in this business for so long. But before we get there, I want to first of all start off by asking you about some commodities. So we'll just go down the list here. And I know we've had a big pullback, and I believe that we're in a commodity super cycle. You know, very similar to one that we saw from 96 to, let's say, 2011. I think we probably started in 2020 when oil was, call it, negative 38 a barrel. And so I believe that we'll most likely see this commodity super cycle last until 2030 or 2035. But as you know, those super cycles, they don't go up in a straight line. They're very, very volatile. So if that's your, I want to, first of all, maybe get your opinion on that idea of us being in a long-term super cycle, then we'll go into the individual commodities.
I'm actually absolutely sympathetic with that thesis, because my belief, and I said this on your show before, is that for 30 years, we've systematically underinvested in natural resources. Right. And when you underinvest in producing assets, in depleting assets, you set up supply shortages. Meanwhile, the world has continued to grow. I'm glad that you described the volatility that these super cycles exhibit, because you can have a 18-month or 24-month downturn in a cyclical bull market, not violate the bull market, but scare the living hell out of the participants. Right. And that has and will continue to happen. The only thing that derails it temporarily from my point of view, and I think this is a real possibility, is a synchronized global recession or depression, where although supply falls, demand falls too. Things like wars are not good for global trade, and the economy. Similarly, a free market in interest rates, which is to say interest rates that showed a real rate of return above inflation, are not good for an economy that's addicted to debt and credit. So the thing that could derail or at least delay the bull market that you are talking about for good reason, I think has to do with a global recession or depression. I would point out that my suspicion is that the ascent of humankind will continue after that derailment, which means that the resource bull market at some point in time is inevitable, simply because most of the world desires a higher material standard of living and the number of people on Earth continues to increase. But that doesn't take away the fact that one shouldn't expect the market to resemble stair steps to heaven.
How do you determine your entry points? Because one of the reasons I like commodities, and tell me if I'm wrong, is because in my mind, it's easy to tell when they're cheap and when they're expensive, because you can just look at a historic chart adjusted for inflation. I always use oil. When it gets under 30, looks pretty cheap. When it gets over 80 or 85, tends to be expensive and kind of revert to the mean. And so I'm sure you could do that with coal. You could do that with copper. You could do that with natural gas, et cetera. So if, let's just say that you believe that we're in this commodity super cycle and oil never gets back down to, let's say, under 30 a barrel, how do you determine an entry point if it's not technically cheap by that definition? Do you use, and I'm going off some of my interviews and what I've read about Jim Rogers, he'll say that you got to buy panic and sell hysteria. So do you try to wait for market sentiment to turn into panic, and that's when you buy, even if it's not technically cheap? Or how should I think about that?
Three answers to the question. We'll do them sequentially. Strategically, that is to say, macro positioning, broad positioning. What I do is I try and find a commodity where the supply of it is essential to the way we live, where ongoing demand is secure. Energy might be an example. Critical minerals, things like iron and copper. Food, agricultural minerals. I look for sectors that are broad enough and where the application is critical enough that I know that I don't have to worry about the demand side of the commodity going away, because if it goes away, our standard of living changes abruptly and for the worse. Mm-hmm. And I superimpose that number that list on commodities that are selling in the global market for substantially less than the cost of production.
Right.
When I have that, I have a circumstance where one of two things will necessarily occur. Either the commodity becomes unavailable and the living standards of humankind decline precipitously, or the price goes up. Mm-hmm. A great illustration you just gave me, which was oil. The International Energy Agency has suggested that the fully loaded cost to produce a barrel of oil, I'm not talking about the lifting cost, I'm adding back general and administrative expense, capital expense, cost of capital, and social rents, like taxation and royalties, is around $60 per barrel. So when oil was selling at $20 a barrel, that meant that the oil industry was losing $40 a barrel 85 million times a day.
Right.
That got rather boring. You know, the industry was losing just the shady side of $3 billion a day. Now, the outcome for this is pretty easy to determine. When the industry is losing $40 a day, its willingness and ability to invest sustaining capital and new capital to maintain oil supplies is non-existent. And consumers have absolutely no interest in conserving because the stuff is too cheap. So when you reduce supply and increase demand, a fairly interesting thing happens. Prices always respond to the upside. Similarly, if you have a circumstance normally where the industry as a whole is enjoying 50% operational net profit margins, which is to say when the cost of oil is $60 a barrel on a global basis and it's selling for $120 a barrel, you need to begin to be cautious. It doesn't mean that supply is going to increase and demand is going to falter immediately, but it does mean that the industry is enjoying sufficient free cash flow to resume sustaining capital investments. And it also means that consumers have an incentive to conserve. And so a lot of what I do from a strategic point of view is look for commodities that are essential to the advance of humankind, where they're selling at substantial discounts to the cost of production. It's ironic that when commodities are cheap, the stocks seem expensive. Because commodity prices are low, the companies are selling at high price earnings multiples because they don't have very much E, but they still got all the P. And at periods of time when the industries are expensive, they seem cheap, which is to say when commodity prices are unsustainably high, free cash margins that the producers are enjoying seem very, very low.
Right.
The second thing that I look at is strategy, and that's what Mr. Rogers is talking about. If you have a circumstance where there's panic in the market, a wonderful example of panic that I missed was when Exxon was thrown out of the Dow index and you had all the index related selling. Obviously, you weren't going to have two quarters of index related selling. It was a one-off, but there was panic around it. There was COVID panic. The oil price had fallen. There was political panic because all the big thinkers in the world decreed that despite the fact that they all flew private jets to Davos, that you and I shouldn't drive.
Right.
And at the same time, there was the one-off selling related to Exxon being kicked out of the Dow 30. That is precisely the type of one-off event that Jim Rogers describes when he talks about panic in the market. So from a strategic point of view, you look at the macro. From a tactical point of view, you absolutely look at the micro and you absolutely look at panic. In the speculative markets that for most of my career I favored, the third thing that I look at is simply the availability of very attractive investment opportunities at what I see as the correct pricing from a speculator's point of view. If you try to get into private placements, private equity placements, and the issuers don't give you warrants, you know, where they give you restricted stock, but they give you no incentive to own the restricted stock, or when you go to make a bridge loan or a mezzanine loan or a project loan, and the prospective borrower says to you that the Bank of America or the Royal Bank of Canada is cheaper. In other words, when capital is hyperabundant, I don't want to be a speculator. When capital is scarce, when the terms and conditions favor the check writer, I do want to be a speculator. I'm in the wonderful circumstance now where strategically for resource investors, life is good. From time to time, technically for speculators, life is good. And for the first time in 3 years, pricing sanity has begun to return to the private placement market. So life is good there too.
So prices are coming down.
Correct.
So
capital is becoming more scarce. Share prices are coming down. The terms and conditions around the deployment of capital are, of course, increasing as a consequence.
And I would assume if we go into a global recession or a U.S. recession, that those prices would most likely come down even further.
One would expect they might collapse.
Yeah. So how do you manage that, Rick, with your, I don't know if you've got a, you know, just access to banks that can give you unlimited capital, or in your own trading account, you keep more of a dry powder, maybe a larger cash position to take advantage. And then how do you know when to pull the trigger if you believe that we haven't seen the bottom of the market or the max point of the recession?
you never get it right.
Yeah, right.
In terms of timing, or at least I never get it right. Bernard Baruch, pretty good speculator, once said the only person who absolutely called the bottom and called the top was a liar. It didn't happen. and I can certainly identify with that. The first thing is that sometimes things are cheap enough. If you think that a stock is worth $4 and you can buy it at $2, you buy it at $2, irrespective of where you think it might go.
Right.
If it goes, which it might, from $2 to a dollar, well, that's pretty simple. If it's still worth four, what was a good buy become a great buy. So you buy more. You might, if you're not financially mature, regret paying $2 for the stock. But the truth is buying $4 for $2 is always a good idea, irrespective of subsequent price action. The second thing that I've learned as I've aged is relative value, which is to say, if I bought a stock, let's say an investment quality stock for 20 bucks, and let's say that the market is such that that $20 stock is now selling for $10. I look at that $10 and I don't think too much about what I paid for it. What I think is what I can do with the $10. And if, despite the fact that that stock is down by half, if there is an opportunity which I think is better, I will, without even a second's hesitation anymore, switch from a less attractive investment or speculation to a more attractive investment and/or speculation. People pay way too much attention to the prices of stocks when they have no opinion as to the value. Right. And price information, in the absence of an opinion of value, is paying attention to a floating abstraction. It really doesn't matter much. People, too, pay too much attention to the price they paid for the stock. The stock doesn't care how much you paid for it. The person who sold it to you doesn't care too much how you paid for it. The person who buys it from you isn't going to care too much about how much you paid for it. When I was your stockbroker, I didn't care how much you paid for it. That doesn't matter. What matters is what you do with the capital that's left over. That's all that matters.
On the questions I get on my live streams, it's just, I think the biggest mistake that people make, and I think this is to your point, where it seems like for whatever reason, we as human beings are hardwired to try to first and foremost predict the price direction. Mm-hmm. So, George, should I buy real estate right now? Is the housing market going up or down? Should I buy gold right now? Is gold price going up or down? Is this price going up or down? And I always say, first of all, just forget that question, because it's unknowable. It's completely unknowable. The only thing that we truly know is it cheap or is it expensive? And if it's cheap, then buy it regardless of what direction you think the price is going. And if it's expensive, go ahead and sell it regardless of whether you think it's going to double or triple or quadruple from here. But that is almost impossible for the retail investor to get themselves in that mindset. Have you noticed that? And what are some tips that you can give us to make sure that we're, thinking about things properly?
I absolutely have noticed it. And I've spent 35 years doing interviews like this, trying to combat it with, I'm embarrassed to say, limited success.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure really why that is. My suspicion is that, unlike you and I, most of your listeners and most of my former clients have lives, which is to say, they think about their family, they think about their jobs, they think about baseball, they think about movies. Not me so much. I think about the process of investing. My vocation is my avocation. So what's completely clear to me is completely clear to me for several reasons. One, pardon my jocular English, but getting my ass kicked as a young man before I learned those lessons, I certainly learned a lot about that. And then being responsible for both mine and other people's money for a very long period of time. In other words, I've been involved in the process. Many of your listeners, were more intellectually involved in the World Series than they might have been involved in their investment portfolio. And, you know, we're asking a lot of people. We are asking people to take ownership of their financial future. Most people would prefer that other people took ownership of their financial future. They'd like the government to take ownership of their financial future. They'd like you or me to take ownership of their financial future, as opposed to being responsible for their own success or failure, which is too bad. And we're asking people too to do work, which most people would prefer not to do. Price information is easy to get. You pull stock up on the computer. Developing an opinion of value requires a lot of work. And people would prefer to think, after a 40-year bull market, that, to quote Doug Casey, you got a hunch and you bet a bunch. That has a happy ending, an unhappy ending, pardon me, when it doesn't work. I hope I've answered that question. The third thing I want to say to people, and this is really hard to get across to our crowd, George, the so-called hard money crowd, that's the need for liquidity. When I tell people that their purchasing power in dollar-denominated savings assets is declining by 8.5%, but they have to maintain dollar liquidity, they look at me and say, what? You know, have you been consuming too much bourbon or something? But the truth is that the negative interest yield that you suffer is an option premium to have the tools and hopefully the confidence to take advantage of periodic illiquidity when other people in the market can't take advantage of it. I have now for 35 years, through thick markets and thin, been extremely, extremely liquid. Yes, there has been a cost to that, particularly a cost now with negative real interest rates impacting my savings like everybody else's. But I have an idea in the next 2 or 3 years, some way, some shape, some form, that liquidity is going to come in really handy to me, George. And I would urge your listeners to, in addition to developing study discipline, to develop financial discipline around savings and liquidity too. Yes.
So basically paying for an insurance premium is what you're doing. Yep. And you know what's interesting, Doug, and I've been thinking about this a lot lately. It is true that you've got a negative carry on your cash position, but only if your expenses are denominated in dollars, right? If you're a Japanese pension fund, I want you to, if you could, tell that story about the big pension fund manager that you talked to and why he owns the long end of the treasury curve. But if you know, if the value of the yen is depreciating and you think it's going to continue to go down, you don't care that the CPI, headline CPI in the United States, is 8.5%. You could care less because your expenses are denominated in yen and those dollars are appreciating in value against the goods and services that you need to buy. So it's a completely different dynamic if your expenses are not denominated in dollars.
I will tell a story, but I'll tell you an interesting thought experiment that I've been doing now for about 5 years, which is to say that I calculate my own balance sheet and my own income statement in gold grams, as well as in dollars. And if you think about US dollars in gold terms rather than gold in US dollar terms, or you think about opportunity cost in gold terms, or if you think about consumer goods in gold terms or your savings in gold terms, I think it gives you a broader perspective about your relationship with all fiat currencies. The idea of the golden constant, I think, should be applied to personal finance too. The point that you make, which is to say that despite all the flaws in the US dollar, it's the best floating abstraction in the world, is important. Doug Casey, I think, brilliantly points out that the US dollar, for all its faults, is the prettiest mare at the slaughterhouse.
Right.
The story that I'm about to tell might illustrate that. Some 10 years ago, and I don't want to name the country, I had the occasion to visit with a portfolio manager for a very, very, very large government-sponsored pension and savings scheme. And while I was looking at their statement of assets, I saw a very large concentration in U.S. Treasury securities. And as I came to know this portfolio manager, he'd been asking me questions for about 2 hours. I thought it was okay if I asked him some. I said, you know, I'm, as an American citizen, I'm very flattered with the fact that you own lots of U.S. dollars. I mean, it seems to me like you guys ship us all kinds of cool stuff, steel, boats, cars, computers, and we sent you back promises printed on pieces of paper. To me, this is a really cool deal. I'm just not sure how well it works out for you. And he sort of chuckled. I kept going on this. I said, you know, if you looked at the United States as a private credit, if you looked at our balance sheet and our income statement, the U.S. Treasury at this interest rate would seem to me to be a lie. And at that point in time, he looked at me and smiled and says, Mr. Rule, what you say, of course, is very true. But yours is a deep and liquid lie, unlike all of the other lies that I hear as an investor. And I said, does that mean that you trust us? He said, oh, no. But we trust you more than we trust each other. And I think that's a very, very interesting circumstance. Delighted for the citizens of this particular country that this particular portfolio manager has been a fairly aggressive deleverager, which is to say that the composition of that portfolio is now much less debt-oriented, still in terms of the long bonds that they hold. The predominant bond is U.S. bond, which relative to other government securities, which he could have owned, I mean, it's been a good decision.
Yeah. And if we go into a recession, he could even have more capital gains on that.
Absolutely. And, you know, in truth, 10 years ago, I could have been a little more easily critical of the way that he was doing his job. We have a circumstance now, and the gold investors in your audience should listen particularly carefully to this. We have a circumstance now where the largest investors in the world are stuck between a rock and a hard place. They've been through 40 years of declining interest rates and benign economic climate. The consequence of that is that the accepted norm is to have 60% of the corpus of your portfolio in equities and 40% in debt. And this 40% debt component has behaved marvelously well for 40 years. I mean, spectacularly well. The idea that you get good capital gains on income instruments is just as good as it could possibly get for you. But that party's come to a halt. Negative real interest rates on long-term debt issuances basically means that having 40% of your portfolio in instruments dated 10 years or longer guarantees that you can't fulfill your pension obligations. In other words, the standard investment allocation absolutely positively guarantees that you will not be able to fulfill your obligations to your pensioners, as an example, unless the rate of inflation falls really, really, really substantially, which I don't think is going to happen. And I believe that we are in the cusp of massive disintermediation in long-term debt instruments from the biggest institutional investors in the world. And I'm not saying that all of that money, that 40% of every big portfolio, is going to flow into gold. What I'm suggesting is that some of the money that has to come out of those bonds because of inflation will flow into instruments that have a millennium long track record for guarding against the depreciation of purchasing power through inflation, which is one of the reasons why I feel so good about my precious metals portfolio.
And I think it's a matter of government policy and timing as well. I think people need to understand that, you know, both of us are very long term. You know, I think I heard you say the other day you're about 5 years. I'd probably even go longer than that. But if people are looking at 3 months, 6 months, they've got to factor that into the equation, because gold fell under 1800 today. And I believe silver under 20, maybe even under 19, which I think long-term is a huge, huge buying opportunity, especially if you consider gold just insurance like I do. But it may go down a lot further if we go into a recession. You know, the 10-year today, I don't know if you saw this, it got under 2.8. Yep. And this is, you know, after the Fed raises to 1.5, it shoots up to 3.4. Now all of a sudden down to, call it 2.79 today. I think it bounced a little bit. But that is the bond market just screaming recession. And, you know, the curve has already inverted twice in the last, let's call it 2 or 3 months. I think it could invert again this week, the twos and tens. So that goes back to, I think, the strategy of having this long-term view on XYZ asset, but then taking advantage of those short-term fluctuations and volatility by having that cash position. Hey guys, I want to remind you to check out Rebel Capitalist Pro. This is the incredible online investment forum that I have with investment experts Lynn Alden and Chris McIntosh. It includes professionals such as Patrick Serezna from Macro Voices. He specializes in options. Tony Greer, commodity trading. Jason Hartman, real estate. And Brent Johnson with macro economics. If you want to build wealth and thrive in this world of out of control central banks and big governments, Rebel Capitalist Pro is the resource you need. So check it out today at georgegammon.com/pro. That's georgegammon.com/pro. We'll see you inside with the fellow Rebel Capitalists that are taking their investing to the next level.
I agree with you completely. I think that every investor needs to have both a tactical and a strategic sense. I know that I was probably 29 years old when that realization came to me. And when that realization came to me, I almost instantly became a better investor. A different part of cash, frankly, George, is that it simply enhances my sense of well-being. It helps me sleep. And at age 69, I like my sleep. You know, the essence of wealth is enhancing your sense of well-being, and cash does that for me. I should also say that I consider personally gold and silver bullion to be cash, albeit volatile cash. So when I look at my liquidity package personally includes, of course, US dollars and some other foreign currency holdings. But it also, that bucket also for me personally, includes my bullion.
Yeah. Okay, so let's go into some of those commodities that you were talking about earlier that might be under the price or the cost of production. I'm guessing uranium's on that list, but what else is on there?
Uranium's a no-brainer.
Yeah.
On a global basis, it costs about $60 a pound to produce it. We sell it for $49. Importantly, there's a very, very, very large structural deficit in production now. Which will begin to be made up, but the incentive price for new production is higher than the fully loaded cost of total production. Given inflation in the supply chain, it's likely that the incentive price to bring on new production is closer to $70 or $75 a pound. Wow. We use 200 billion pounds a year. That number is rising rapidly, and we produce 120 million pounds a year. and that gap is going to have to be made up.
What is keeping the supply side at a level to where prices are coming down? Is it just all this backlog of supply that we've had over the years still being flushed through the system?
Yeah, I mean, two things happen, both of them wonderful from my point of view. In an earlier, more benign time, the United States and Russia decided that the fact that we each had enough weapons-grade uranium, each of us, to kill everybody on Earth 12 to 15,000 times, right, was probably surplus inventory. And so we had this wonderful circumstance where the sort of so-called megaton to megawatt program where we began to decommission and blend down a bunch of weapons grade uranium, which, although it was hard on the uranium market, was a wonderful thing for humankind. You know, we're now theoretically sane enough that we believe that, given the fact that the United States has the ability to kill everybody on Earth 900 times, the Russians are believed to be a bit more insecure. They feel better being able to kill everybody on Earth 1,100 times. Right. That perhaps we have sufficient weapons-grade inventory. But that had a big impact on supply. The second thing that had a bigger impact on supply is, heading into the last uranium bull market, Kazakhstan was an unimportant player. Kazakhstan, in the last bull market, developed producing capacities that are 42% of the world supply of uranium.
Oh, wow.
And as we were building up capacity during the last bull market, all of a sudden Fukushima happened, which took 25 million pounds a year of demand out of the market and took it to demand heaven. And it took it to demand heaven from a country that had been strategically reliant on nuclear power, simply because nuclear power was so efficient. The Japanese could store a reasonably small amount of material that would be enough to power Japan for 6 or 7 years. So a country that had the largest inventory of uranium relative to consumption came out of the market, and all of that inventory became supply available for sales. So you had sort of a trifecta of plurality of supply over demand, which has taken now almost 10 years to rectify itself, but it is certainly rectified. The other thing that changed the uranium market, of course, is my former employer, Sprott, taking over what had been called Uranium Participation Corp and turning it into the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust. And, you know, coming into the market, I mean, we've now bought 55 million pounds of uranium. This has gone to supply heaven. It's not like Sprott trades it with utilities or sells it or anything. It goes into a storage facility and it stays there. And then I think it's obviously tightened up the spot market, because the spot market has moved from $18 a pound to $50 a pound. That much demand will do that sort of thing.
But it's come down recently, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it shot as high as $62 or $63 a pound when people were afraid that the impact of Russian sanctions would be immediate. And it's declined from $63 a pound to $49 a pound as the market began to assert itself again.
Is it worth exploring any companies in the space, or is it just better to buy the physical through Sprott?
The lowest risk strategy is to buy the physical through Sprott. Now, your listeners need to know I'm the largest shareholder of Sprott. So in a sense, I'm talking my own book. When they buy the Sprott Physical Uranium Trust, it indirectly benefits me. But still, if you have a circumstance where you think the price of uranium must move from $49 a pound to $75 a pound in 3 years or 4 years, you know, that's a laydown. I mean, it's absolutely a laydown. You will get a better response, if I'm right, buying select equities, but you'll take more risk. There's not an awful lot of risk associated with buying something that has to go up, throwing it in a warehouse, and once a year counting drums. That's what an investment in physical uranium is all about. There is, of course, more operational risk buying the individual uranium producers, and there's more reward too.
Now, I know with the gold trust, you can take delivery of the gold. Can you take delivery of the uranium in case I want some from my backyard?
You know, we decided not to make that an exchangeable unit for reasons that are fairly obvious to you. I know that many of your listeners and many of my former clients are stackers. And yeah. For very good reasons. I'm always leery about people holding gold and silver at home for their own personal security. But I don't really like the idea of all of my closest friends having a couple of drums of the yellow cake in their basement.
All right, let's move down the list. What else would fall into that category of the price being under the production cost right now? Are the gold miners there?
No. Not at all. The gold industry is fairly profitable at this price. And I need to say that normal supply demand parameters don't extend to gold, because almost all the gold that's ever mined is still supply. Because it's a substitute money, we do an interesting thing with it. We take it from a nice safe hole in the ground called a mine, and we put it into a less safe hole in the ground called a vault. And we spend some money doing it. My case for gold is very different. My case for gold goes to utility. I need to say that if you look at the commodities complex around the world right now, the only other commodity that is stupidly underpriced is water. And it's stupidly underpriced because the price of water is controlled politically. So it's not unlikely to stay stupidly underpriced. There's a couple of things that you need to know about investing in water. First of all, you have to invest in water in dry places. I live in the Pacific Northwest, where the challenge is to make the stuff go away, you know? you need to have regional scarcities of water. And you also need to own water in places that can afford to pay for it. There are some very dry places like Eritrea or Djibouti where you can own all you want, but you can't sell it. So that doesn't work. The biggest complexity with regards to water, though, is that the allocation isn't a function of utility, but rather political power. Water flows unnaturally uphill to votes rather than naturally downhill to money. If you look at markets like California, 85% of the water that's consumed in California is consumed for agricultural purposes. Agriculture in California delivers 2.5% of the state's GDP. My farmer friends are not going to like to hear this, but water in California is worth more money for flushing toilets and brushing teeth than it is for growing rice in the desert. And you would have less of a problem of water allocation in California if you allowed various constituencies to bid against each other for the water. That isn't happening.
So how do you go long? Do you go long that through going long food?
What I did, 30 years ago, 35 years ago, I simply bought water rights, and it worked out for me very, very, very well. One of my favorite puns now is that one of the problems with water as an investment class is it's illiquid. you can easily sell water rights, but you can't buy them anymore. You know, the big farmers and some of the big financial interests have bought them up. You can buy as an example, entitled farmland, that is to say water, farmland that has water rights attached to it. Farmland is becoming expensive too. You'll recall that the first interview that you and I did 3 years ago, I was sort of pounding the table on farmland in the upper Midwest. Sadly, I was too right, which is to say it's almost unbuyable now at prices that generate an economic return. But there are two stocks that people could look at, both very liquid, so be careful buying them. One would be J.G. Boswell, which is the largest corporate farmer in the state of California. People regard it as a cotton grower, which it is, the largest cotton grower in the United States. But more importantly, it's the largest private water rights owner in the state of California by a country mile. The second would be Limonera, which is a company that farms particularly citrus and avocados. Its real attraction is that it owns the 2,200 acres fee simple land in Santa Paula, California, which is slowly being converted from things like flower fields to single family residential. But in addition to that, it's a very large water rights owner in Ventura County in California. And I think that the stock is priced basically to reflect their sales of lemons and avocados, which I don't think reflects what the future sales value of their real estate portfolio or their water portfolio will reflect. Please don't everybody run out and try and buy these two stocks. Use limit orders. They're both illiquid. Boswell in particular, J.G. Boswell isn't listed. It never went public. It trades over the counter. It's been an over the counter stock for 110 years. You almost have to make an appointment to make a trade. So buy this stock with a very long perspective, and please use discretion the way you trade it.
Yeah. What is the magic number, talking about the production cost, for things like coal and copper? Because Long term, I really like coal because it's probably the most hated energy source. And it reminds me, I just the other day I was listening to Jim Rogers' book, Hot Commodities. I don't know if you remember that one from like 2003, four. One of his favorite commodities at the time was lead. And I really got a kick out of that because I remember during that time frame how lead was just public enemy number one. Yep. I mean, it was getting in the bloodstream of kids and people were ripping it off the walls because it was in the paint and everything. And, you know, he gave his bullish argument on it. And it sounded very, very similar to what you hear today in coal. And then I remember after listening to that book, I went and looked at a chart of what lead did from like 2005 to 2008. And it literally went parabolic. But I mean, anyway, what are your thoughts on those two?
You can afford to hate lead if you hate electricity. You know, if you weren't willing to have batteries. We talk about all these wonderful battery metals. The lead acid battery, irrespective of the inroads lithium is making, is the battery on a global basis that matters. coal price, I mean, people don't realize this, but the best performing commodity in the last 2 years has been coal. You know, Biden doesn't like it. Greta doesn't like it. None of the big thinkers like it, but everybody who wants the light to go on likes it. You know, everybody wants to flip a switch and have the light go on. It's highly amusing to me that the Germans in their wisdom shut down their nuclear fleet. And they've replaced the base load that they used to generate with non-carbon generating nuclear with lignite, this brown, sulfurous, dirty, ash-heavy coal. It is absolutely hilarious to me that Ms. Merkel's green legacy has been to double the utilization of coal in the world's allegedly greenest economy.
Right, right.
The coal price right now is very stout. While two things, I guess, burden the coal industry. One, capital is becoming less and less available. More of the big thinking banks have decided for various reasons that they won't provide capital to the coal business. I would note that ICICI Bank of India and China Commercial Bank are not among those banks. So capital is still available to the coal industry. But the coal industry is becoming uninsurable too, given the fact that among my business interests is a company that provides environmental insurance for the coal industry. I'm delighted with the fact that my big competitors, who could stop me anytime they wanted to, have decided to exit an industry. That's important to me. But the coal price is very strong. What isn't strong has been, you know, the coal equities. I draw your attention, and this is not a stock recommendation, but the diversified multinational miner Glencore was able to acquire, I believe, a 50% interest in one of their coal operations from a partner. This coal operation is a world scale mine. 30-year mine life, best quartile worldwide in terms of cost of production, best quartile worldwide in terms of return on capital employed. They were able to buy the interest in this coal project that a partner had for a 1.5-year payout in a 30-year reserve. That's the opportunity that you see in the coal business. But by my traditional metric, which is to say cost of production being higher than the price that you can sell the product for, that isn't true. The world is really constrained in terms of coal capacity now. Nobody wants to admit that they're selling it. But basically, India and China and other pariahs like Germany will take all you can sell them.
So what would you, so the price is run. It's definitely not a quote unquote cheap based on its historic price adjusted for inflation.
It is
not cheap compared to the cost of production. So if you were long-term bullish, what would you look for? Would you just look for the price to come down to a specific level adjusted for inflation? Would you wait for it to get under that production cost, or would there be another
catalyst? I think it depends on who you are as an investor. If you are an investor like most who are underinvested in natural resources, I think you also need to look at the incentive price, which is different than the producing price. So as an example, right now, in the copper business. We are selling copper for $3.80, $3.90 a pound. And that's plenty for existing production. You begin to shut down existing production at some number like $2 or $2.50. That belies the fact that we haven't opened very many new copper mines in the last 30 years. And all of the existing production, it's kind of my age, you know, it's long of tooth. And the incentive price for new copper production is probably closer to $4.50. Wow. So in a commodity like copper, where you're facing a circumstance where supply is falling off a cliff and demand is increasing rapidly, you can be a little bit more generous with regards to strategic parameters, which is to say, and I think you can do this with uranium too, given the fact that the supply deficits are going to be so egregious, I think that you can look at the incentive price to bring on new production. And while it's not as conservative a substitute as total production cost for existing production, I think it's valid.
How do you determine the incentive price or incentive cost?
What I do is I pay attention to the industry-wide forecast from groups like Mineral Economics Group, BHP, or some of the industry groups. In the energy business, I sort of grit my teeth and listen to the economic forecast from the International Energy Agency, which ironically is very anti-energy, but they do a fairly broad-based economic review of various energy industries on a global basis.
Great. So now you briefly touched on copper. I don't know if there's anything you want to add there. And then I'd really like to get your input on silver. Seems like the price is really getting down to a level that may even be considered cheap when you adjust for inflation, looking back at a historic chart.
I think as a speculation, silver's dirt cheap. Dirt cheap. I can make less of an economic case for it, a utility case. But as a speculation, it's dirt cheap. And let me explain that. If you look back at the last two precious metals bull markets, the 1970 to 1981 bull market and the 2000 to 2011 bull market, what you see in both circumstances is that silver underperformed gold in the first half of those bull markets. Silver being more of a momentum-driven speculation, gold being driven at least initially more by fear than by greed. But when gold established the momentum in those markets and broader pro-precious metal sentiment picked up, silver, perhaps because of its inherent volatility, perhaps because of its lower unit cost, greatly outperformed gold. Given that I think that we are in the mid stages of a gold bull market, I think that leadership sometime in the next 2 years will switch from gold to silver once gold reestablishes upward price momentum. And I think that the volatility around the silver trade means that speculators need to begin to pay attention to it, particularly because it's so determinedly out of favor.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's just, again, screaming recession. So, that's kind of my next thought is that we most likely go into recession, let's just say Q3, Q4, maybe Q1, 2023. And that's when the commodities really, really start to come down. And then I think the government's response to that recession, along with the Fed, is going to take us to our next up cycle of not only inflation, but also potentially commodity prices. So when the government response comes in to, let's say, a recession, and everyone says, whew, okay, that's over, the Fed has fixed it, they've kicked the can down the road, but they've done so by running a $10 trillion CARES Act instead of a $5 trillion CARES Act, then, you know, that industrial component of the silver price takes a sigh of relief, and then you're kind of off to the races because of all the quote unquote money printing. That's kind of my base case. What do you think about that?
I agree with the broad swaths of it. I should disclaim it by saying that you're younger than I, so you're more inclined to make predictions that are time sensitive than I am. I joke that my commodity price forecasting track record is almost unblemished by success. I'm less pessimistic than you about industrial demand for silver, because I think that silver is being utilized by sectors of the economy that are going to be more recession-proof. Silver is a spectacular germicide. And so the utilization of silver in things like water treatment and purification is increasing at double-digit numbers. And the world's need for more water and better water, better purification, better treatment, I think inures to silver's benefit. Silver is also the most critical component in solar power. And the big thinkers of the world, the same one who don't want you to buy coal, do want you to build solar plants, even in places like Germany where the sun doesn't shine. So I'm pretty bullish about the industrial applications of silver. I suspect that the economic scenario that you have described is more likely than not to occur. I believe, like you, that we're in some danger of an economic slowdown. I believe until that happens that the U.S. government in particular is inclined to raise interest rates as far and as fast as they are able, which in the near term probably increases the strength of the U.S. dollar and decreases demand for gold and silver, although I'm impressed with how sticky the gold price has been in the face of dollar strength.
Right.
But my suspicion is that at some point in time, an economy that's become addicted to easy money and artificially low interest rates will react to higher interest rates. And I suspect that the reaction of that, as you suggest, will be a fairly dramatic Fed retreat. And that would be the sort of kickoff moment for a precious metals bull market. And that kickoff market will herald a time when silver outperforms gold. It's worthy to note, too, our mutual friend Doug Casey has said this, that the market capitalization of viable silver companies is so small that when the generalist investor comes into the silver equities market, to quote Doug, it's like trying to siphon Hoover Dam through a garden hose, that there simply isn't the market capitalization in the sector to support the flow of funds that comes into it. I've watched it occur twice before in my life, and I'm hoping to get to experience it just one more time before I shed my mortal coil.
So let's go back to what you're saying there, because I think that's really important when you're talking about the gold price, how it should be a lot lower based on where the dollar is, but yet it's still remaining, although it's down a bit, it's still remaining sticky. Has that been a strong, powerful indicator that you've used in the past? Is that a pretty accurate form of signal from the market saying, whether it's oil, coal, gold, et cetera?
I've only noticed it in gold. It's probably occurred in other commodities too, but I don't know it because I haven't been able to, that's not the way I think. And those correlations have been too often for me sources of amusement. Twice before in my career, gold has done well during periods of U.S. dollar strength. And that's told us a couple things. The first thing it said is that when the U.S. dollar is doing well against all currencies, when gold treads water, it means that gold's in a raging bull market in non-U.S. dollar denominated accounts.
Right.
In other words, gold is fulfilling its function in most currencies in the world. But the second thing that it says is that some aspects of the market, particularly savers, don't believe in the dollar thesis. And you are beginning to see savings in gold or diversification out of the predominant currency, even during periods of time when there's U.S. dollar strength. Remember that the value of the float of gold and gold-related assets relative to the float of value, at least price in the U.S. dollar, is minuscule. And it takes very small disintermediation out of dollar-denominated investments into gold-denominated investments to really propel the price of gold. And when you have a circumstance where gold is at least treading water, when the market conditions are ostensibly lined up against it, traditionally that's been very bullish.
Do you think the price is manipulated?
Oh,
if not, if so, or if
your
not,
readers are going to hear, readers are going to hate this.
No, but I think you and I see eye to eye on this. But I'd love
all markets are manipulated.
Yeah.
Okay. I cut my teeth in the early 70s in the Vancouver Stock Exchange. So I got to see manipulation up close and personal, you know. But if markets as large as the S&P 500 index and LIBOR are manipulated, and they've been proven to be manipulated, clearly in the short term, all markets are manipulated. And gold and more likely silver are fairly easy to manipulate in the short term. Yeah. If you look at the fact that the futures market is so large relative to the spot market, it's pretty obvious that an intelligent trading syndicate could, as an example, short the time ladder in silver out 2 years, 2.5 years, utilizing a lot of margin, and then borrow a bunch of physical silver, sell it in the overnight market to depress the physical market, which then has an outsized impact on the futures market. If you were short, you know, $1.5 billion or $2 billion in the futures market, which is no great trick given the liquidity in those markets. And then you were able to sell $50 or $60 or $70 million in the overnight market, driving down the futures market by 5 or 6%. The amount of money that you had to pay on the borrow to sell into the physical market relative to what you could make being short the futures market is infinitesimal. And it's pretty clear that when you watch the silver price and you watch these large sellers in the overnight market when there's no liquidity, that that's precisely what's happening. What I don't believe is happening is that there is any decades-long conspiracy involving big governments. You know, the people who lost the war on poverty, lost the war on drugs, lost the war in Vietnam, lost the war in Afghanistan. Terrible. I mean, the idea that these morons who can't deliver the mail or educate the kids can engineer a 25-year-long precious metals market conspiracy doesn't make sense to me. Similarly, the idea that the largest banks in the world that exist to generate quarterly cash bonuses for their executives, the idea that these banks would engage in a decade-long conspiracy that had a negative interest carry, which is to say where the position cost them margin as opposed to earn them a spread, that isn't the Goldman Sachs that I know. Right. The Goldman Sachs that I know exists to generate quarterly cash bonuses for its executives, and you don't deliver quarterly cash bonuses by having a net interest charge. So I don't believe that there is any systemic decades-long conspiracy to suppress the price of gold and silver, especially over the last 40 years, where declining real interest rates and a strong US dollar was doing the job for them. Yeah. Why would you spend billions of dollars depressing something that was going down anyway?
That makes sense. That's kind of what my view was, is short-term, yes, long-term, most likely not.
I don't know who's smart enough to do it.
Yeah. I know we're running short on time, Rick. So last question here. What do you think about Russian stocks, Lukoil, Gazprom?
Well, I got my head handed to me in them. They are very, very cheap. I was starting to buy very aggressively early on in the conflict. And mercifully for me, the big thinker saved me from myself, which is to say they were delisted before I did my personal balance sheet more harm than I did.
Yeah, but I think they're still trading on the Russian Stock Exchange, aren't they? If you somehow have a way to buy it that way. I don't know if that's
And I should say that several of my clients have now opened accounts at Gazprom Bank.
Right. Okay.
Gazprom Bank will happily take accounts from the Americans if you have the courage to do it. Note that what were already the cheapest stocks in the world have become substantially cheaper to the extent that, as an example, Gazprom, I think, trades at 1.5 times free cash flow.
And it just tanked to the other, I think it was yesterday, because they announced they weren't paying their dividend.
Well, they aren't paying, they can't pay US dollar dividends because they can't get US dollars. So what you need to know is that if you open an account with Gazprom Bank, I haven't done this, by the way, but if you open an account with Gazprom Bank and you surrender your London receipts or your American receipts and convert them into Russian ordinaries, that the Russians will pay you dividends at Gazprom Bank, but they'll pay them in rubles, which you can't spend and which they can't even send to you. What I understand that you can do, and I don't know this to be true, is that you can, with some of the Russian issuers, including Gazprom, elect to join a dividend reinvestment program where they pay you your dividends in additional shares, which you can't spend either. But, you know, your risk becomes, do U.S. sanctions extend to Gazprom Bank? Will the Russians decide, will the oligarchs decide, listen, this is an easy way to victimize U.S. investors? Will Putin say these guys are our enemy? They're sanctioning all of our executives, so we'll sanction all the Americans. We'll confiscate their holdings in Russian companies. Will the U.S. decide that U.S. people can't hold accounts in Russia and can't own shares in Russian companies? For myself, about 2.5% of my portfolio is now denominated in Russian securities. My suspicion is that 5 years from now, I will regret not taking that up to 10%. But I understand some of the objection to understanding to owning Russian securities, simply because I dislike the way Russia engages in its own foreign policy decisions, even more than I dislike what the United States does. And that's a mighty statement.
Right.
You know, people criticizing Russia should take into account that the U.S. defense budget is larger than our next 9 largest competitors combined. And while the Russians and the Chinese are certainly expansionist powers, the last time I was informed, there were U.S. troops in 71 foreign countries. So we need to take a look at ourselves in a moral sense. I'm not condoning what the Russians have done in any way, shape, or form. I'm just saying, if you're casting a moral net, you need to look at home, too.
Yeah, the way I've always said it is I'm against all governments. Yep. I think they're all right corrupt. They're all crooks, you know,
right,
whether it's the Canadian government, the U.S. government, the Ukrainian government, the Russian government. Doesn't matter. I'm for the people. And I'm against the politicians.
Right with you. Right with you. Right with you.
All right, Rick. So do you want to tell us about the bank? And then we need to get the link or the URL for people to buy tickets to your conference.
Yeah, I'd love to talk to you about the bank. I'm, as I think I've told you, George, celebrating retirement by backing a team to start a new bank. It's the people that built something that many of your subscribers will remember fondly, which is to say EverBank. That's a bank that we took from an online concept in 1999 to a $28 billion bank before we sold it some years ago. And we're doing it again. I think any of your listeners who are unhappy with their current banking relationships, which probably extend to all of your listeners, might be interested in our bank. Among other things, other than doing things like hedging interest rates, we're not going to be derivative speculators. We're going to be a bank that has money in it, which means that we're going to have a reasonable equity slice relative to our deposits to insure our depositors. We are going to offer deposit products that suit our customers rather than just suit ourselves. So these include foreign currency denominated certificates of deposits and checking accounts, indexed linked deposits, including indexes around precious metals, so that you can have a deposit product that gives you upside to precious metals prices. We are going to offer self-directed IRAs with LLCs under them. So you can do things like own duplexes and triplexes and fourplexes, which you operate in your IRA. And we are going to greatly expand my own personal precious metals lending business, which is to say people who hold precious metals for their own account in certain storage facilities, Brinks and Loomis among them, will be able for the first time at reasonable prices to borrow against their precious metals holdings, either to use that cash to do something else with, or in fact, to buy more precious metals. So I would describe this, George, as a bank for you and I, an intelligently constructed bank, a bank that has very low non-interest expenses because it won't have any brick and mortar branches. So a bank that will be able to pay in the best decile nationwide on deposits, a bank that will denominate deposits in asset classes that are of interest and convenience to you, a bank that will lend to real solvent people against real negotiable collateral. An old-fashioned bank, I guess. Think of us, George, as a community bank.
Where
we define our bank in terms of interest, which is to say contrarian investors, value-oriented investors, precious metals investors, natural resource investors, nationwide, a community bank that isn't defined by geography, but rather a bank that's community is defined by philosophy and interest.
That's fantastic. When is it going to open?
Rick, that's up to the banking regulators. I should give you a sidebar there. You know, I'm no fan of regulators, but in starting a bank, I've dealt with the OCC, the FDIC, and the Fed. And I have to say, despite the fact that I am ambivalent at best towards those institutions, the employees of those institutions, the regulators that I've dealt with, actually have made me more optimistic about the future of humankind.
Good.
I found them to be smart, dedicated, empathetic, which was not my anticipation, George. I suspect that we will be able to open the bank this calendar year. Maybe October, maybe November of this calendar year. We'll see.
All right. Well, bottom, when you do, you got to come back on so we can.
I really want to do that. For those of your listeners who care, we have a website, battlebank.com.
Battlebank?
Battlebank. The name obviously describes the fact that we'll battle for our depositors, we'll battle for our lenders, we'll battle for our employees, we'll battle for our shareholders. Okay. We are combative people. So go to battlebank.com. We'd love your business. Absolutely, positively love your business. We proved last time with Everbank that we deserve your business. And we're going to do that again. The other offers I have to make are the normal ones, although they're expanded. Any of your listeners who've enjoyed our discussion about natural resources and precious metals are invited to continue it with me. If you go to my website, ruleinvestmentmedia.com, and list the natural resource stocks in your portfolio, please no crypto, please no tech stocks, please no pot stocks, just the natural resource stocks. I'll rank them 1 to 10 personally, and I'll comment on individual issues where I think my comments might have value. In the question and comment section at ruleinvestmentmedia.com, if you care about my bank, write bank, and I'll send you information. If you care, too, about what private placements I'm participating in, I don't run afoul of solicitation laws anymore by telling you about them because I'm retired. I'm not soliciting. So if you care about the private placements I'm doing with my own money and you're a accredited investor, write in placements, and I'll send you notification where allowable of the placements that I'm participating in. Understand that because I was allowed to doesn't necessarily mean that you will be allowed to, but at least you'll know what I'm doing and why. And if the discussion that we had about the Natural Resources Investment Symposium in Boca Raton, Florida, July 26th through 29th is appealing, remember, absolutely no questions asked, money back guarantee, write conference, or I suspect that you're going to post a conference link.
I'll definitely do it in the description. The editor will probably put it up right here on the screen,
which is probably the easiest way to do it. But if for some reason you want my own take on the conference, feel free to, in the question and comment section at Rule Investment Media, say conference. So that's rankings, bank, placement, conference.
And then what's the URL to buy tickets?
I have no idea.
All right, don't worry about it.
All I have to do is make sure all my speakers get there at the right time, which, you know, given some of my speakers like Doug Casey, it's going to be a full-time job.
I'm sure. All right, Rick, thanks again for your time. Can't wait to do it again, buddy, and good luck with the conference.
George, thank you so much. And I do look forward to having a greater discussion with you and your listeners about the bank. It's the most fun I've had for a very long time.
Yeah, likewise. And I can't wait to open up an account there myself. So
we will best to make you ecstatic as opposed to merely happy.
All right, Rick, have a good one.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you for listening to the Rebel Capitalist Show. For more content like this, check out the Rebel Capitalist blog at georgegammon.com or go to the George Gammon YouTube channel.